Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference. You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference presented by Tom Jordan, Network Operations Center Manager at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. The session is entitled Data Center Infrastructure.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this session entitled Data Center Infrastructure. I'm Chad Kynes. I'm the convener for this session. I want to remind everybody that session evaluations are online this year, so you can go to any kiosk and do the evaluation there, but also go to the conference website and do your conference session evaluation at that place as well. As a speaker, I really appreciate that kind of feedback, so I encourage you to take the time and give Tom your feedback with regard to this morning's session. So let me do a brief introduction here. Tom Jordan is the manager of the Network Operations Center at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. The NOC provides infrastructure IT services to the Whitewater campus, including enterprise networking, server administration, ERP and database system administration, and data center operations. Prior to coming to Whitewater, Tom was a technologist in identity management and middleware at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Tom has been involved in public sector IT for over 10 years and has led a number of initiatives, both technical and organizational in nature. And with that, I welcome Tom to the podium and to speak to us about data center infrastructure.
Thank you. First off, can everybody hear me okay? Okay, sounds great. I want to apologize. I've been given some warning that there might be some hecklers in the room, so I just wanted to apologize in advance for that. They mean well, but they just don't know any better. So today I'm here to talk about data center infrastructure. And I first became interested in data center infrastructure about a little over 3 years ago when I took a job that made me responsible for it. So it's kind of funny how that works. In my first few months on the job, my boss, our CIO, and the technologists that work for me made it very clear to me that modernization of our data center was a definite priority. They were struggling a lot with the limitations of the facility that we had, and of course, because of those things, I chose to make it my priority as well. And I did what any red-blooded manager would do in that situation. I read trade magazines. As I was reading trade magazines, I found a couple of interesting, highlights of corporate data center merges and things like that. And one particular of a multinational corporation that had 12 data centers scattered across the country, or across the world, actually. And they had over the course of about 5 years collapsed that down to three primary data centers at a cost of something like $500 million. And I thought, wow, that's impressive. Maybe we could do something like that. So, you know, I reasoned the fact that we're quite a bit smaller, and I thought, you know, I bet, you know, if we had 1 year and $100 million, we could probably make a big difference, right? So, yeah, that didn't fly very far. Instead, we took a more incremental approach. What we did was to take our data center facility, look at it in place, and try to bring it up into contemporary standards for hosting modern equipment, following trends that that we're seeing in the industry and things like that. So that's a little bit of what I'm going to talk about today. I'll be describing UW-Whitewater's data center environment and our challenges, talking about some of the infrastructure areas and how we went about improving them. Then I'll talk a little bit about the TIA 942 standard for data centers and how those standards guided our decision-making process. And then towards the end of the presentation, I'll talk a little bit about blade centers, virtualization, and greening the data center, and how data center infrastructure plays a role in those things. So UW-Whitewater is it's kind of an interesting organization from the standpoint that we're not a small organization. We have roughly 10,000 students, a number of undergraduate and graduate majors. We're a single campus location with about 45 buildings on campus. One of the things that makes Whitewater interesting is that we're right in that range between big and small. You know, almost small enough to take a more casual kind of a one-man shop approach to things, but not quite. And then almost large enough to take large IT organization practices and principles and things like that and make them stick. But again, not quite. We're kind of right in the middle there. And so that's always been a unique challenge for us. And our data center was no exception to this. There's enough there that the concept of a room with some servers in it isn't going to scale to our organization. But at the same time, we hadn't yet really gotten to the point where we were thinking, okay, this needs to be an enterprise class hosting facility. What do we need to do to make it that? So our technical environment, we're mostly gigabit Ethernet switched in the closets, routed at the core. We've got a couple of main aggregation points on campus. All of them come back to our campus data center before going out to the outside world. Probably a pretty traditional workstation environment. And in terms of our political environment, we've got a fair degree of centralization with some server hosting happening outside of central IT. And that's a situation that we're addressing. Our data center renovation project was part of our strategy for addressing it. On the data center front, our technical environment, we've got about 150 servers that we run. Most of them at this point are rack mount. We've still got some towers kicking around that we're dealing with through attrition. You can see the splits there, maybe 60% server Windows 2003, 30% NetWare or Linux, so on and so forth. We're about 80% physical at this point, about 20% virtual, although our virtual rate is growing slowly as we move forward. We've got a fiber channel SAN environment. Our SAN footprint's about 20 terabytes. We use gigabit Ethernet for server connectivity. We host a number of departmental servers in our data center. This is another reason why it needs to be a modern, sustainable infrastructure. As we go out to campus and we try to convince them of the wisdom of hosting with us and the disadvantages of hosting an application internally within the department, it's important for us to be able to show them a modern, contemporary data center hosting facility, so that we can convince them that that central IT. Owning, operating, managing their services is something that they're not going to regret. This, in turn, is important for us from a security standpoint as well, because we're working on network segmentation, firewalling, and things like that. And as you guys know, servers out in department field areas can be really difficult to manage when it comes to setting up a firewall network infrastructure that that categorizes and isolates traffic based on usage. So this was an important strategy for us as well. So our data center challenges. Our data center really started life as a data processing center. You can see some pictures here of the cohabiting. Yes, that is carpet on the floor. That's definitely kind of an interesting thing to experience in a data center. The power, the cooling, the flooring layout, we're all designed for kind of an older mainframe environment, an environment where the cooling densities are very low, the power densities are very low. We had a combined operations area and machine room area. We had a lot of people working in the same area that we had all of our servers running. And as a result, as you can guess, nobody was happy. The people weren't happy, the machines weren't happy. It's just not a good shared environment. We even went so far as to have a paper room and an I.O. window. Anybody here have an I.O. window in their data center? Okay, so we're not the only ones. That makes me feel good. So we knew that we needed to modernize. And, of course, there's a lot of ways to go about that. You can build a new facility if you've got the financial wherewithal. We didn't. You can relocate your facility if you have a viable option on campus for doing so. We didn't. You can outsource the operation. You can contract with a design firm. What we decided to do, because, of course, infrastructure planning and strategic planning really go hand in hand, is that we wanted to work through the process ourselves so that we had a good enough sense of infrastructure planning to be able to do infrastructure and strategic planning at least in conjunction with each other, if not dependent on one another. At the time that we started this, the Telecommunications Industry Association released the TIA 942 standard, which is the TIA standard for data center spaces. Most people are familiar with TIA from the telecom standpoint. They're the authors of the 568 series of standards. 568B is what you'll see in commercial datacom and telecom wiring applications. TIA 942 is a standard that talks about how to lay out your data spaces, your data center spaces, how to do structured cabling in the data center, power humidity requirements, things like that. So what we learned in this process, you might think this is obvious on the face of it, but appropriate infrastructure is critical to support modern equipment for future trends, to meet operational and compliance needs. The big thing that we've found is that you can go up to a certain point without attention to infrastructure, but as you start to get into things like blade centers or more high heat density or power density equipment, you start to run into barriers, and then you have to go back and do the remedial work of addressing your infrastructure even while you have a shortcoming in the equipment that you're trying to host. And the infrastructure that this includes, which we'll talk about in this presentation, are things like physical layout, cable plant, power distribution, cooling, fire suppression, physical security, and access control. So what are the trends out there? As most of you know there's a strong trend right now towards consolidation and virtualization for a couple of different reasons. Greening the data center is one of those reasons. Efficiency of utilization of physical resources and staff time is another. But as we do this, as equipment becomes more compact, it pushes the power densities and the heat densities higher and higher. We may use less energy overall, but we're pushing it into a tighter space, and we need, once that energy is converted to heat, we need to get it out. And facilities need to be able to scale for those densities accordingly. So the first thing that we did was to sit down and do some work in terms of power distribution. What we did was to calculate our expected power loading per rack, per server enclosure, both now and figuring out a growth rate previously and what we expected in kind of 5, 10, 15, and 20-year horizons. Now, of course, 10, 15, and 20-year horizons aren't necessarily accurate or realistic to be able to think about in IT. So what we tried to do was to set best case, worst case, and moderate case for each of those, and then to factor in, at what point in this are we going to hit true facilities limitations? At what point, at point 15, in year 15 at our current growth rate, are we just no longer going to be able to use this building? If that's the case, then there's no point in building out power loading expectations beyond the point where the facility is no longer usable. So we tried to make sure that our scaling was realistic in terms of the facility that we had in place. We wanted to make sure that what we did today was able to support 5 and possibly 10-year projections, and that the plan could expand into 15 or 20-year horizons. What we didn't try to do was to outfit the room outfit the facility for 20 years down the road. A strong component of greening the data center is to make sure that your capacity represents what you're actually trying to do, that you're not building out or overbuilding based on what you think you're going to be doing 10 or 15 years down the road. You may have the floor space in mind 20 years down the road, but you certainly don't want to do things like provisioning UPS, PDU, air conditioning and things like that for a load that you think you might have in 15 years. What you're going to do is you're going to end up burning a lot of energy until you get there, if you get there. You're better off planning an incremental approach that lets you build those things out as needed. So let's talk a little bit about an ideal power distribution situation. We'll start with a server enclosure. What we try to do in our environment is to make sure that we've got... I like to try to keep things as simple as possible so that the right thing can happen with the minimal amount of thought. So what we do in our environment is that we deploy dual-circuit PDUs in our server enclosures, tie those back, black circuit, white circuit, to a power distribution unit, one or more power distribution units in the data center area, and then behind that, a UPS and a utility service provider. In a perfect world, we would have a second utility service provider that would be able to supply a B grid. In doing this, what we would be able to do would be to put two different power grids in the same rack with a multi-power supply machine. We can connect them to different circuits on different power grids. Again, keeping it simple, your instructions to the server administrators are make sure that your power supplies are on different colors and different strips. And once they've done that, you've got this taken care of. You're on different circuits, you're on different power supplies, or you're on different power grids, and you don't have to worry about it. Again, of course, we want those tied into a backup generator to make sure that that we can run in the event of a loss of utility power. Our scenario wasn't quite that well. We, as a campus, have only one utility provider for our campus. Adding another utility provider was not an option for us. So we made do with what we could. Again, this kind of takes you back to the concept of don't overbuild past your facilities limitations. If you can't get a utility provider, a second utility provider, there's not a lot of sense in building a second grid just yet. you know, if that becomes an option for us, then we'll be able to do that. Until then, you know, there's not a whole lot of point in building out that infrastructure. So past power distribution, that kind of brings us to cooling. So let's make an assumption here that machines are almost perfectly efficient in turning electricity into heat. And that's a rule of thumb that we've used in a lot of our data center planning, that every kilowatt of electricity that you put into the data center, you're going to have to pull out in heat. That kilowatt of energy, if you think about it, and you know, you go through the calcs and stuff like that. Okay, it's one and you know, it's 1.3 horsepower. It's a little bit less than the average home's energy consumption in an hour, which means that our 50 kilowatt data center is, you know, has the energy footprint of a reasonably sized subdivision. You know, you can do your own calculations in your own data center, but I think that makes it a little bit more real in terms of the energy that we're talking about. You know, that same kilowatt of heat is enough to boil a couple gallons of water. You know, to take it all the way from freezing to boiling. We don't necessarily recognize this. We don't necessarily recognize the energy flowing through our data centers because the power densities and the heat densities are spread out. If you consider a 4-foot by 8-foot enclosure, that's 32 square feet of surface area on which to spread out that heat. You put your hand on it, you'll notice that it's warm, obviously, but you won't necessarily get a good feel for the energy that's passing through there. If you were to concentrate that energy and grab onto it, you would certainly know it. So our challenges with cooling. We had a huge excess in cooling capacity for the load that we were running. We had 75 tons of cooling capacity and about 15 tons of actual load. Despite that fact, we still had heat problems. The heat problems were primarily due to airflow and distribution, poor cool air delivery. The floor was not sealed well. We didn't have good rack venting in place, and we had obstructions behind the racks. It's really important, to think from an energy standpoint. You're going to put this energy into cooling. You have to make sure that energy is used effectively. If it's not, then you can really waste a lot of money, energy, and things like that by overbuilding the capacity of the room and still using the cooling ineffectively. So for your consideration, I'd like to ask you, what's the principal difference between a server and a jet engine? Well, primarily fuel economy. You know, you can talk about initial acquisition cost and life cycle maintenance and stuff like that. My vote is for fuel economy. So let's talk a little bit about rack orientation, because I think it's an important part of dealing with cooling and making sure your cooling is effective. Server enclosures, of course, have a front side and a rear side, and it's important to remember which end is which. When we take our little jet engines and we put them inside of the server enclosure, they're going to inhale through the front and exhale through the back, and we need to keep that in mind whenever we're dealing with cooling and airflow. We get our cool air in from the front. It gets pulled through the servers. It gets pushed out through the rear. What we typically observe in our data center is that we see a 10 to 15 degree raise in temperature from the inlet side of the rack to the exhaust side of the rack. You know, that's 15 degrees that air picks up along the way. Consider, the traditional stacking racks in front of each other, front to back, front to back. We've still got an inlet side and we've still got an exhaust side. We need to be aware of where our exhaust is going. In this particular model, of course, the airflow, the exhaust from the rack in front, is going to warm the air even before it's had a chance to cool the second rack. So by that, we're wasting a lot of our cooling right there by heating the air before it's done what we need it to do. Another problem that we see sometimes and that we saw in our data center was both front and rear venting. Again, racks have a front. We've seen kind of a shift in data center cooling strategies over the course of the last, say, 10 years or so to get away from trying to control the ambient temperature of the room and to really try to manage the 6 to 12 inches in the front of our equipment racks. Ambient temperature is still important, but what's really important is inlet temperature, because that's going to dictate the, and that's what we're going to use to control the temperature of the equipment. So if you've got airflow coming up both at the front and the back of the rack, essentially what you're doing is creating a couple of high-pressure zones, both on the front and the back. The side effect that has is that it's going to trap the hot air in the back of the rack. Your air is not going to be able to circulate out of the rack, and the high pressure from the venting in the rear of the rack is going to trap that hot air there. You'll get good air coming in, but unfortunately your hot air is not going to leave. So, again, you're going to have a temperature problem as a result. So contemporary data center technologies and room layouts and things like that. And this is kind of key to the TIA 942 standards for organization of a data center is hot aisle cold aisle, what's called hot aisle cold aisle orientation. The idea behind that is to organize server racks and things like that front to front and back to back. What that lets you do is use your cold air in a cold aisle and let that vent through the fronts, and then discharge your air into a hot aisle, which is not vented to the floor. And then pick that up with your air conditioners and recirculate it. This is basically the most effective way that we found to date to be able to make most effective use of the cold air that we're trying to distribute and keep the hot air isolated from the fronts of the equipment. Now, it's really important in this process at the same time to make sure that you close up the open spots in your rack, you know, that you're using things like blanking panels and blanking rails to make sure that hot air doesn't recirculate to the fronts of the racks and interfere with the cold air that you're trying to distribute. So what does hot aisle, cold aisle mean for an actual data center layout? Again, you know, you see that the distribution of the exhaust is away from the fronts of the equipment. So what this means in terms of a floor layout is that as you lay things out, you'll see that you'll only have a couple of aisles of either perforated or vented flooring, and those will be in your cold aisles. Your hot aisles you'll keep cold, or you'll keep closed because you want that hot air to circulate either up to the ceiling, or you know, you may choose to use ducted venting or something like that to get that back to the air conditioning units to be able to recirculate. This is a similar technology that you would use if you weren't using a raised floor system. You would probably just use directed cooling or venting or veining to be able to accomplish the same thing. I've got a note here that one perforated tile is 1 ton of cooling. Generally, since a forced air system requires a certain amount of air pressure under the floor, and that was one of our biggest challenges in terms of the way that we dealt with cooling in our data center, the fact that our floor was improperly sealed, it's important to make sure that you don't perf out your floor so far that you lose pressure. This is kind of a balancing act. You need to figure out where the tile placement needs to go to be able to get cold air all the way up to the tops of your equipment racks and things like that. The rule of thumb that we've encountered is that for every perf tile you put down, you should have 1 ton of cooling available. So if you've got if you've got 20 tons of cooling in your data center, you probably get 20 perfs to work with. You need to figure out how you're going to place them. If you've got 40 tons, you've probably got 40 tiles to work with, and you need to figure out how to place them. It's just a rule of thumb. You may be able to go over that, but understand that past a certain point beyond that, you're going to start to lose floor pressure, and you might not be able to push the cold air all the way up to the tops of the racks. So what this did for us, what it gave us was 10 degrees. 10-degree drop on the inlet temperatures, 10-degree drop on the exhaust temperatures, with no change to the air conditioning set points or dead bands or anything like that. 10 degrees for us was huge. I mean, that was a very big deal. Based on our annual energy costs, it's about $30,000 a year. So, I mean, that's some green. Next thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is cable plant. Our cable plant as we started was, it was kind of traditional data center. All of our cabling was done under the floor, and we kind of had this perspective that it was out of sight, out of mind. Everybody kind of knew it was a problem, but it was not a problem that we had to deal with on a regular basis. So we switched our approach a little bit with that, and we changed our cable plant infrastructure over from an underfloor direct point-to-point routing to a more structured cable plant that used overhead distribution and actual distribution points in the enclosures themselves. The most important factors that we found here are to keep it clean and keep it organized. If you do that, a clean cable plant provides better airflow to the equipment. Clean laid out means that you're not throwing your hand into a pile of cable. It's going to limit damage to cable and connector. It's going to minimize the likelihood of unintended change when the wire that you tug on was connected to the wire that you didn't want to tug on. Overall, it's far more pleasant to work with. It makes changes easier to plan. It makes it makes the number of dependencies that you have to manage a lot fewer. Because what you've got is right out in front of you. It's clean. It's well labeled. It's more easily understandable. Overall, the philosophy that we wanted to have here was, this is our cable plant. We want it to be maintained over time. So let's put it out in the open, so that mistakes and shoddy workmanship can't hide. you know, this way our cable plant is open for public ridicule, and if somebody does a messy job, everybody can see it. You know, and then on the teams, what we try to do is to reinforce that standard, you know, that that a poor cabling job is definitely going to get you a good ribbing, you know, if not some other kind of ridicule. So to talk a little bit about considerations in the cable plant, bend radius is important, especially when we get into Cat 6 and Cat 6E cabling. The general rule of thumb is no less than 18 times the cable diameter. Copper doesn't like to be pinched. When it's pinched, it changes its electrical properties. And as a result, if you bend a cable a little bit too tight, you're going to affect the electrical characteristics of that cable. In severe cases, it's not going to test out the level that you want. I mean, we've certainly seen situations where cable that's been pinched has failed to test at Cat 6 or even at Cat 5 because of the bend in the cable. From a routing standpoint, try not to restrict airflow. I've got pictured here, some of you may recognize the Cisco 6500 chassis. One of the things that's interesting about the 6500 series from Cisco is that, and something that you need to keep in mind when designing airflow and cabling and things like that, is that the 6500s route side to side rather than front to back. One of the things that drives, and this is just a good principle generally, is that when you're speccing equipment racks, you want to make sure that you've got a sizable vertical on either side of those things. Number one, so that you can do primarily vertical cable management. And again, you know, things like vertical fingers and angled patch panels are great for this. If you can avoid horizontals, I'd recommend doing it. But to do that, you need to make sure that your racks have got adequate vertical space on either side. So, you know, if you're going to go with the... With the 3.5 or 4 foot enclosures, I would definitely recommend that. In terminations, you know, clean and well-dressed panels, clear and consistent labeling are really important. I mean, this is when you talk about the risk of change management, this is one of your greatest tools for minimizing the risk of change management. One of the other things that we do is we color code for greater clarity. What we've got here is, you'll see blue cable in these pictures. This is local data center copper. We have other color codings that we use. We use aqua for sand fiber. Obviously, single mode and multi-mode are yellow and orange, respectively, when we talk fiber. Our console or KVM network, we use yellow, for example, so that in the back of a server rack, you've got a couple of different colors going in. You've got a good chance of saying, okay, this is the cable that I'm unplugging. I've got a better chance of it being the cable that I intended to unplug. To mention just a little bit about you know, the importance of clean terminations. Prior to this, we had some network cabinets that had no kind of vertical management in place. It was really just kind of the copper waterfall coming out the front of the equipment that a lot of us are probably familiar with. We did a blade swap in that environment, and we did a blade swap in the new environment. It was great because we could compare the two. In the previous environment, we had about 4 or so hours of downtime that we needed to schedule to do this blade swap, because of the time for documenting, unplugging, and working cable around itself and all of that stuff. It was pretty messy. When we got the blade out, we found out that the weight of that cable had actually stress fractured the blade itself. So, okay, call the vendor for 4-hour response to get the blade replaced. Overall, we planned for 4 hours. It took about 8 hours. And primarily that was just getting back to the state that we started in. After we made this change, we got the same type of work done. Now we swapped out 100 meg blade for a gig blade, 48 ports, in about 20 minutes. You know, so we went from an 8-hour maintenance cycle to a 20-minute maintenance cycle based on the fact that the cable plant was that much better documented and easier to work with. So some cabling standards resources that are out there. Of course, there is TF-568B, which is the Commercial Building Wiring Standard. And certainly, you know, networking folks are going to be familiar with that one. TIA-942, as I mentioned, is TIA standard for data centers. Also out there, and I find very helpful, is the TDMM, which is the Telecommunications Distribution Methods Manual, published by BICSI. This is an organization that that is very much in the construction trades and deals with low voltage and other types of communications cabling in the building trades. So a really good resource. The TDMM is huge, but on the other side of it, it will tell you anything that you need to know about structured cable distribution. So what does the TIA 942 recommendation talk about in terms of how you organize your data center? Well, first off, what the TIA 942 recommendation recommends that you establish is a main distribution area and then horizontal distribution areas to each of your equipment racks and cabinets. What they don't recommend is that you try to do point-to-point from a main distribution to everything in your data center. They look for a more structured distribution than that. Again, the idea behind that is that you want to minimize, by minimizing the scope of a change, you minimize the possible impact of the change. If your change involves work at the main distribution area and the rack and cabinet, well, the scope of impact of that work includes the main distribution area as well. If you're doing something like racking and installing a server, you can minimize the impact of that by dealing just with the rack, the path from the rack to the local horizontal distribution area, and then hopefully that should be it. By minimizing the scope of the change, you can try to minimize the potential impact of the change. The way that we incorporated this was basically to define a main distribution area in our data center. We tried to go equidistant to all of our racks just to help on cabling lengths and things like that. But then additionally, what we did was to make sure that in each of our enclosures, we had a horizontal distribution area that was established there. And this consisted of anywhere from, 24 to 96 ports of copper for data, 24 to 96 ports of copper for console, and multimode fiber in the form of a fiber cart for our SAN distribution. So what we were able to do there is use our overhead cabling network, our overhead cable distribution plant, to be able to go from the main distribution area to the horizontal distribution areas. Server administrators that are working only need to work within the particular aisle and enclosures that they're working with. One of the challenges that we had to overcome was the fact that we were talking about hosting departmental servers where departmental admins wanted access. We didn't want them to have access unfettered to everything that was in the data center. This is similar to what you might see in a hosting environment where, if what you're renting is a cabinet, you'll get keys to your cabinet, and any changes that you make there, you've got the resources to make the changes that affect your equipment. Hopefully they've minimized your ability to make changes that impact other equipment. So that's kind of what TIA recommends and how we went to incorporate it. So to talk just a little bit about our overhead cable distribution scheme. We use ladder rack for cable distribution. As you can see, we have our copper on the top rack. The yellow stuff that you see is a Panduit product called Fiber Runner, and it's used for essentially supporting and protecting fiber, various forms of fiber optic. We use this both for our single-mode fiber coming in from the campus. We use it for our multimode fiber. We have some multimode connectivity on campus as well, so this comes up to the data center. We use it for distribution to our networking areas and things like that. Some of the things that does for us is that, when you have your add changes and deletes, it's very hard to actually disturb fiber unintentionally in this mode. It's well protected, it's well contained, and the distribution path itself enforces things like bend radius. The corners are routed such that you can't exceed a cable's bend radius as long as you keep it in the trough. So that's definitely a plus. And again, with the waterfalls and things like that, you'll see supporting devices that make sure that the cable's following a bend radius and doesn't exceed that. Something to consider here is just the weight of a bundle of cable when you're dealing with something like this. You might think that cable waterfalling will naturally hold a certain curve. Make that bundle big enough and its own weight will blow that curve. So it's important to make sure that you consider things like waterfalls. So I wanted to give you a couple of contrasts here. This is actually a very tame example. It's not from our data center. It's from a wiring closet. But it was a recent example from just a couple of weeks ago that came up that I thought you guys might be interested in. As you can see, we've got a good bundle of blue cable here. Clean, well-dressed, well-organized, lots of room and everything like that. And then we have the white stuff that's definitely a different example. What I want you to think about is, at some point, somebody's going to need to trace something in that mess. They're going to need to put their hand in that mess. And I'm telling you, nothing good's going to come of that. So those are some contrasts. How about some similarities? Anybody recognize this guy? Anybody seen any similarities there? So, okay. If you find your data center or any of your wiring closets touched by his noodly appendage, then it's time to pay some attention and work on the cable plant a little bit. There's another network that we need to not forget, and that's our grounding network. It's part of TIA 942. It's part of basic safety. It can save your equipment and it can save somebody's life. The whole point behind a grounding network is if you have a faulted power supply, if you have a faulted piece of equipment, the idea is to find a path of least resistance out of your data center that doesn't involve going through somebody's body. To do that, you need to make sure that you've got a grounding network in place, and that means every enclosure. What we do is we actually run our grounding network right alongside on the ladder with the rest of our cable distribution, and then we tie down to each particular server enclosure as just along with everything else, so that we can make a grounding connection to each one of our enclosures that ties back then to the building ground. So. Next up, beyond the cable plant, we began to work on fire suppression. So I don't know if we have any former, current Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, that might remember the fire triangle. But for a fire to start, it needs three things. It needs fuel, it needs air, and it needs heat. The way that we control these things, fuel's pretty straightforward. I mean, you have to have some stuff in the data center, but you have a lot of control over what you put in the data center and what you choose not to put in the data center. So, you're the one that provides the fuel. Think a little bit about what fuel you want to provide, and I'll touch on this a little bit later, too. Controlling the air side of the fire triangle are gaseous systems. These are things like Halon or FM200 or Energen. As most folks probably know, Halon is kind of frowned on at this point due to its impact on ozone. It's not a very environmentally friendly gas, so we're seeing replacements like FM200 and Energen that work under the same principles. They suppress the fire by removing air, but they're a lot more environmentally friendly. And heat, of course, is suppressed by sprinkler systems. So sprinkler systems. When we first started talking about them, I said, wow, water in the data center? How about that? I'm a little nervous about that. How many people have sprinkler systems in their data center? Okay, so it's certainly the number is growing. This is for the state of Wisconsin, it's a new standard for data centers to use fire suppression or sprinkler-based systems rather than gaseous systems. We had a particular challenge in our area because the room itself was rather poorly sealed. From what we could tell, we're lucky that we never had a fire in the facility because there's a real good chance that a gaseous system never would have put the system out in the first place. So just because of the poor sealing in the room. A sprinkler system is something that can get around that. And it can get around the environmental issues of dealing with something like Halon. It can get around some of the safety issues that you run into with gaseous systems that actually push oxygen out of the room. I mean, we kind of like oxygen. It's important to us. So, we need to, when we take it away, it becomes kind of a safety issue. So water in the data center is usually done through things like dual interlock sprinkler systems. The reason they call them dual interlock sprinkler systems is because they require two different activations before the system's charged with water and discharges. They're usually used in conjunction with something called a VESDA system, and VESDA stands for Very Early Smoke Detection Apparatus. This is basically an air sampling system that will, consist of a piping network in your data center that will pull air from various places and sample it looking for smoke or other types of debris that might be indicators of pre-ignition. These systems can be incredibly sensitive to the point where they can pick up a power supply pick up a power cord that's got a knot in it. They'll pick up the heat that's generated by that, some of the pre-ignition particles that are put off by that, and can trigger an alarm. Usually they work in a couple of different stages and are tied in with a sprinkler system to say, okay, we've reached, say, level 3 or level 4 in our VESDA system. We'll consider that one of two interlock activations in our sprinkler system. The other thing that needs to happen is that a head needs to fuse. You actually need to have a sprinkler head fuse. Most heads will fuse in the neighborhood of 155 or 160 degrees, which really means at the ceiling, on a typical ceiling, a sprinkler head at 155 degrees usually means 1,500 degrees on the floor. So, you definitely need some heat in the facility to be able to produce that. And then only the fused head is the one that discharges. They're also referred to as dry pipe sprinkler systems because they are the pipes themselves are dry until the system is activated, and then the pipe that's only the pipe that's been activated is going to be flooded. The pipes themselves are held at a higher than room air pressure, so that the system can recognize, you know, if somebody's moving a ladder and knocks a sprinkler head off, rather than discharging the system, they can recognize that and say and send a kind of an administrative alarm to say that this has happened, but we're not going to discharge as a result of it because we didn't get that VESDA alert. You know, we didn't get any sense of smoke in the room. We just got the evacuated pipe, the loss of pressure in the pipe. So what can we do about fuel? I mean, obviously, we have to have stuff in our data center. There's not much we can do about that. We have a choice about what stuff we can do. This is important not just from a fuel standpoint, but from a keeping it clean standpoint. One thing that you can do is to create staging areas for storing and unboxing equipment. We have an area adjacent to our data center that we use for handling all of our data center stock. Cardboard is a nasty thing to put in your data center. It flakes. It puts off particles. You know, every box that you get in has been on a warehouse floor somewhere. You know, it's collected dirt along the way. It's not the kind of thing that you want to keep in your data center. Where you do, you know, it definitely adds fuel. It adds dirt. You know, and typically the activities that you have around prepping equipment, unboxing, moving things around, you know, packaging, styrofoam, cardboard, all of that stuff is stuff that you want to keep out of your data center. The best way to do that is to make sure that you've got a staging area where, you know, your sysadmins can do that kind of work and not have to do it in the data center itself. Hopefully, by the time you're bringing a piece of equipment into the data center, you're bringing it in either partially assembled or fully assembled, and the thing that you're bringing it in to do is to rack it and get it connected. And on the other side of that, power down and remove equipment that's no longer in service. I mean, most of us go through some period of wait time where, you know, we believe a system has been removed from service. We'll keep it running for a little while to make sure that if we find something's necessary, we can power it back up and go on from there. You know, sometimes that stuff lives in racks longer than it needs to. It can add fuel. Certainly, it consumes energy in the process. And I'll talk a little bit about that when I talk a little bit about greening. The other thing to talk about is physical security. Here's where we get into access control, you know, the entry into the facility, the exit from the facility, and things like that. You know, and here you might have electronic access or some other mechanism, you know, the gatekeeper at the door, what have you. Identification of personnel is important. It's important to be able to distinguish employees from contractors, from vendors. You know, an entry, sign-in, and badging system can accomplish this for you. Surveillance is important, both from a video standpoint, to be able to determine what happened in the data center, and from an environmental standpoint as well. I mean, you need to make sure that you've got some remote signaling that can tell you, is there water in my data center? Is there a heat problem in my data center? If I don't run my data center 24 hours a day, how am I going to find out that these things are happening, you know, so that I don't come in and see the fire trucks and the fire department hosing the place down? I'd like to know a little bit sooner than that, if possible. Something to keep in mind is that a lot of these physical security audit compliance things are things that we're starting to see in regulations. We're starting to see them mandated by our various governing bodies. Good example of that is the payment card industry's data security standards. Those of us that handle credit card transactions and store the card number in the process are subject to a pretty high degree of scrutiny in terms of what we need to do to comply with PCI. There are, in the PCI standards, there are a number of physical security controls that are included in that push us towards good physical data center security. So I wanted to talk a little bit about greening the data center and what that means. You know, I mean, there are definitely a lot of technologies that we can talk about when it comes to greening the data center. We've got a lot of them in the exhibit hall right now. What it comes down to, though, is first of all, understanding your energy consumption and where you need to be spending it. Reviewing your utility usages and costs to understand, you know, is what you're trying to do reasonable, both in terms of, you know, the energy that you're using, the cost that you're paying. What surprises me a lot, and this primarily owes to the fact that we don't necessarily see in our institutional accounting systems, we don't necessarily see the cost of energy consumption in our data center. We actually have to go looking for it. And when we go looking for it, it's kind of surprising. I mean, I never would have thought, you think about our data center facility, just walking through it, that it's got the energy footprint of a sizable subdivision, or that we spend, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in energy costs related to our data center. So Once you get a feel for things like that, we can strategize on how to reduce energy costs. Free cooling, if you live in a colder climate, is a great way to do that. Free cooling allows you, if you've got something like a closed-loop air conditioning system or a chilled water system on campus, it allows you to use outside air temperature rather than compressor energy in your cooling to be able to get the cooling that you need. Air conditioners work, of course, liquid-based air conditioners will work by sending a fluid stream out to an evaporator where the equipment's chilled, bring it back to a compressor where it's further chilled, and then cool the air as a result. In a cooler environment where you've got outside air temperatures below freezing, the trip out to the evaporators might be, or the trip out to the condensers, rather, might be enough. So from that standpoint, free cooling is a great thing. We typically don't run compressors at all from November until about late March, early April. Limiting air mixing is another good thing to do. I talked a little bit about blanking panels and hot aisle, cold aisle, and everything like that. But every time hot air comes in contact with cold air, before the cold air has done its job, that's wasted energy. So we want to make sure that we limit air mixing. One thing to look for when you're consulting on buildings or on construction or renovation is to look for LEED certification. LEED is from the U.S. Green Building Association, stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It's a building industry design standard that folks can follow to create energy efficient spaces. Most effective way that I've found to run green is to run less stuff. We can do that through a number of ways, to run more efficiently with what we're doing, to get rid of the old stuff, consolidate, virtualize, and things like that. And on that front, we can talk about blades and virtualization. But when we think about running less stuff, one example I like to use is at this point, in 2008, how much sense does it make for you to spin 36 gig drives in your data center, for example? I mean, does it make sense to do that? We consider, energy and things like that. Blade servers are a way to do that. And again, as I talked before, they'll use less energy and generate less heat as a comparable piece of equipment. The problem is they put it in a much smaller package, and we need to increase our ability to extract that heat and provide that energy more efficiently. Blades and virtualization. Virtualization means fewer physical servers, not fewer servers, so you've still got to manage that. You've got to deal with the fact that you're still running this number of servers. It can help with staffing indirectly with standardization of hardware, standardization of images. If you get into ITIL, this is kind of the release management portion of the cycle. The problem with automation typically in IT, though, is that when you automate a workload, the remaining workload is typically at a higher skill level, and you'll need to make sure that you're keeping that into account. So in summary, data center infrastructure is critical for supporting upcoming trends. We talked about consolidation. We talked about virtualization. A thoughtful design of data center infrastructure can support your modern operations and can limit your energy costs. At the same time, it can make sure that you're building in pace with growing rather than building out excessively and then having a lot of underutilized capacity that you still need to fund. As we talked about with the cable plant and things like that, it can also improve operations and infrastructure stability. A good, clean, solid infrastructure also pays off in people's ability to work with it without having a lot of unintended consequences as a result. So that's the end of my discussion. If folks have questions, now's a great time. Right. Mm-hmm. We haven't been able to negotiate any financial incentives in terms of money back from campus to us, but we are working with our campus facilities organization on an overall green initiative, so they have kind of a package of what the campus is saving, and we're able to articulate our portion of that. We're about 300 square feet. In that neighborhood? We did. We looked at in-row cooling. We made the determination that our rack density, our power densities and our rack densities were, in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 kilowatts. And we felt that our forced air system that we had in place was able to support up to, say, 6 or 7 kilowatts. We made the decision at that point that we would go with underfloor cooling up until that point. When we hit those higher densities, we'd look at in-enclosure or in-row cooling strategically for the areas that we need in it. 24 inches. Well, we contracted some of the construction. One of the things that we did was to raise the ceiling. We contracted that out to our facilities folks. The actual cable runs and the cable plant build out and everything like that, that was all of our NOC staff. That was our NOC staff doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, you said that you didn't have to separate the electrical grids.
Right.
But every server pretty much you're gonna order a dual power
supply. Yep.
Well, how does it go back? What does
We have a single power grid, and we have a single power distribution unit for our data center. What we do, though, is we have several different panels on that power distribution unit. So what we try to do is to make sure that the PDUs in the enclosures are, each PDU is dual circuited. So we make sure that each circuit is on a different panel, and each server goes into more than one circuit. So we've got some redundancy there. We don't have full facility or full utility power redundancy, but we do have redundancy against circuit failure and things like that. So if somebody in an enclosure blows a circuit, everybody that's connected to multiple circuits should be able to survive that. We have a single UPS. The cost segregated by components? No, I'm sorry, I don't. I'm sorry? Total cost for the project? Probably about $150,000. Maybe $200,000.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom.
Yep.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Real Networks enables digital delivery of distance learning coursework, athletic events, and more to students anywhere. Information at realnetworks.com.